What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Pinnacle Performance Podcast. Today, I have Kyle Dobbs for you guys. And if you guys know, if you guys follow me, I'm sure you guys have also heard of Kyle, many of you. And Kyle is a wealth of knowledge when it comes to the body training, respiration, skeletal position, all these things that I look forward to digging into with him. So Kyle, thanks for being here.
Hey, Connor. I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
Yeah, this will be fun. So you just got done with this OHPS summit where you had a lot of really intelligent, really good coaches come on and talk for a couple of days. So I was just curious, how did that go?
It was an adventure. You know, I think we definitely learned a lot for the next time, and it's something that we hope to do annually. So it was really fun. It was really fun getting to coordinate with the coaches and kind of see what they were working on themselves and the information they were getting ready to put out. And it was really nice. It was a good collection, I think. It was a good wide range of just ideas, philosophies, you know, training environments and application, even different training populations from that perspective. So I think it ended up being a pretty well-rounded event. We got really good feedback on it, so that's always good. It was our first time doing it, so we had a lot of fun.
Awesome. And your talk in particular, you talked about programming with a couple of other guys. What were like the main points you wanted people to get out of that presentation?
Yeah, my business partners and I, James Servi and Matt Domney, we talked about just kind of programming and periodization schemes based on kind of categorization of goals and using those categories to determine everything from exercise selection to phase selection. And, you know, one of the big things that we kind of see is there seems to be a kind of an absolutist mentality when it comes to variability versus specificity in programming. Mm. And we see that as more categorical thinking, right? So when we look at specificity in programming, we look at those as performance-based goals with empirically based outcomes, typically. And for us, those are usually going to be output-driven exercises, especially with the strength athletes that we tend to work with. And and those are going to be things where, you know, in our world, like, we don't care as much about respiration, and we sometimes even let athletes, you know, leverage extension. And these things are usually primarily anaerobic by the way we train, whether it's looking at short sprints or it's looking at like a 1RM squat. Where again, being able to leverage extension and brace and not caring about respiration through that rep range might actually result in a better outcome, right? Than trying to breathe your way through it and be sensorial and doing all those things. And I think, again, true variability accounts for a time and place for both of those thought processes. On the other end of things, when we start looking at kind of our competency and our capacity buckets or categories, that's where we look at from a competency perspective, we look at motor learning, right? And a lot of these things are what we would consider like our kind of lower base sensory motor drills. It could be respiration drills. It could be a lot of other things. Client preference even kind of depends on that sometimes. And then we look at capacity driven drills where we look at repeatable effort, right? And that's where we use a lot of constraints and exercise selection, which allows us to put people into positions and shapes that allow them to kind of do the things that we're looking for from a positional and orientation perspective, to get quote unquote neutral, to have posterior expansion, to be able to kind of leverage those shapes for better overall movement quality. And we typically use those things for either just improve variability from a movement perspective, right? Or to even fill in gaps from a health perspective on some of our more performance-based athletes.
Mm-hmm. I think it's something I've been thinking about more is the breathing stuff, the positional stuff. It's great. It's fun. It's necessary in a lot of cases, but a power lifter, for example, which is an easy way to think about this, like they get tight. They assume the orientations their body is in because that benefits their performance. And like, that is something that, you know, they want to be tight. That extension is good for what they want to accomplish for their goal. So if we completely took that away from them or took it away to a significant extent, that could perhaps impede their performance. So like, all this stuff is great. This positional skeletal stuff, it's wonderful, but ultimately it's just a tool to lift heavier weight and do it more often. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, context is always going to be key. you know, with everything in life. And one of the biggest things that we look at is for a sport like powerlifting, right? And what extension is essentially doing with the individual athlete is it's turning them anaerobic, right? It's closing up the rib cage. It's not allowing for inhalation throughout that range of motion. It's recruiting more musculature in the upper back when we start looking at the lats and the traps and the rhomboids, some of those big, large muscle groups, right? It's adding compression to the lower spine again, recruiting more paraspinals. And people are getting wide and as externally rotated as possible, right? Because they want to generate torque and they want to generate power off the floor, whether it be a deadlift, a squat, or a bench press. And for that, you know, that is a meaningful strategy to produce those outcomes, right? The other side of that is, and that's where specificity really comes into play, right? Is we want them to leave that posture on the platform, right? I don't necessarily want you walking around all day like that. You know, I want you to be able to access inhalation. I want you to be able to breathe and not be out of breath when you're walking up steps, right? Uh-huh. I want you to be able to rotate your femurs and kind of get neutral within that position from both a pelvic and ribcage perspective. So what we look for is trying to create athletes or kind of, again, produce athletes that are able to do both within the appropriate task orientation, right? So when you're in the gym and you're doing those things, you can assume that position and produce great outcomes. Right. When we're going through the accessory work, can we get you in a different position? Can we explore other ranges of motion? Can we get you familiar, right, with the accommodation of stress with another ranges of motion, just to fill in gaps, right? And I think that's an important concept because, you know, again, where the athletes that we see are typically reaching a plateau of some sort, right? They've leveraged extension to the point where they're reaching diminishing returns, right? Either their output is dropping or they're getting banged up is typically what happens, right? So we're working on giving them more movement options to kind of alleviate both of those things potentially. Mm-hmm. And again, that's one very specific example. Like we might also be working with a distance runner, right? A marathon runner who, again, if we look at those buckets categorically, there's a large area of specificity there, but now we're looking at a completely different type of specificity where we're looking at driving aerobic capacity, right? And we might not be so much on the performance end of things because we want that athlete to be super aerobic. We want them to be able to access inhalation through that range, right? So at that point, we're working on work capacity. So a lot of our movements are going to be in a more neutral position. And the training is going to look completely different, you know, and if we're working with more of a gen pop client, there's probably going to be even more variability involved, right? And we're probably not going to be leveraging extension that much at all, right? Just enough so that if they do hit those ranges in everyday life, it doesn't, you know, throw their back out, quote unquote, or, you know, slip a disc, quote unquote, or things of that nature, right? We want them to be able to express those ranges of motion without injury or pain or anything else, right? So people are going to self-organize. We are going to see compensatory strategies based on a task. And we want people to be able to express as much variability and as many different ranges of motion as possible when the environment dictates their appropriateness. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's always looking like if we're developing a training program, the first thing that we look at is the task, right? The sport or the lifestyle, the goals of the individual. And from there, we base our assessments around that task to determine the individual's ability to perform it. And our exercise selection is going to be determined by what they're lacking or what they need or what they need to leverage more of to reach their goal. Right, we might have a strength athlete who's just not strong enough. They don't need any corrective exercise, right, based on those terms. They just need to get stronger. They haven't trained enough to reach a point of diminishing returns, right? So we could spend a lot of time, you know, quote unquote, prehabbing them with corrective exercise that they don't need, or we can just drive strength to the point where we can actually apply those things in a needed position. If we're looking at a gen pop client, again, we're going to look at their daily lifestyle. We're going to look at the movement that they have and train from there.
It's very well said. And the thing I admire a lot about just like looking at what you said as a theme is the language that you use, and you're very intentional with it. Every sort of every sort of aspect of your programming and just kind of been reading your content over the last couple of years, it's very clear that you are very large on context, as you should be, as people should be, because that is really what dictates the approach that you use at a given time. But you use words in a very powerful way, in a way that's easy to understand, but also appropriate. You don't just throw scientific terms out. You don't just use language that's too dumbed down. It's appropriate in the context that you use it in. So I think that's something that I've always admired about what you and the Rebel Crew do in that regard. So kind of transitioning to coaches, coaching coaches. That's something that I have some consultation stuff I do. You have your group program and also a variety of other consultation work that you do. I think this would be kind of cool to just kind of talk about the common themes that we see with people who are seeking to learn, people who come to you and they say, I want to be a part of your group program. What are some things that you see that are common themes within these kinds of individuals? And in your opinion and experience, what do you think are some priorities that we could maybe shift around, like things that we should be spending perhaps a little less time on, things we should be probably spending a little more time on, generally speaking?
That's broad. But we'll roll with it. I know you like those questions. Mm-hmm. I understand that I have a very strong demographic bias, right? So if you found me on the internet, like you probably belong to certain circles and have taken certain systems and have specific acronyms after your name, right? So the people that typically come to me are very intelligent trainers that aren't as successful professionally as they feel they should be. And one of the first conversations that I typically have with these people, you know, is, you know, they're wanting to know what book to read or what course mm-hmm. to take. And meanwhile, they've got the alphabet soup after their name, right? And at that point, I have to look at them and kind of have them objectively think about if education is actually their limiting factor. Right. And typically it's not, right? You know, education is a tool, right? But just like any tool, it has to be applied correctly for any kind of utility. And what we start working on with them is creating things like the actual client experience, creating systems that lead to more efficiency within their training and their philosophies and their processes. And then we start looking at it, what their model actually looks like from a training perspective, right? So one of the first things I start with anybody that I work with is we start looking at just core values and training principles, right? And this is something that I've gotten from my more corporate experience. I was a national director and have done thousands of interviews over my career. And this is a question that I always ask people or prospective, you know, hiring candidates. And we talked a lot about core values. And the majority of the people that I had in front of me didn't know, right? They didn't know what they believed in, right? They could tell me all day long what other people believe in, right? And the same thing happens with training principles is I ask people training principles and they start listing off systemic beliefs, right? Or something that their favorite influencer on social media said. And I just keep digging into why is that important? Why is that important? Why is that important? What does that mean? Right? And we typically get to a point where they say, well, because so-and-so said so. And I say, but what do you think? And why, right? Like, I want to get to the root where people are thinking for themselves, right? Where we take in this information and we can critically think about our own experience, our own education, and determine the value of it within our own training environment. Because again, I can talk all day long about my personal training model, but I've been in the fitness industry for 15 years. I've trained 20,000 plus sessions. I've managed 1,000 plus trainers at one time, right? I've overseen national businesses and multiple locations within different markets. My experience is going to be very different from most of the trainers that I work with. I've been in the game long enough that, you know, my first phone when I was a trainer was a Nokia brick, right?
I don't even know what that is.
I was pre-smartphone, right? There was no social media. there was no Apple iPhone, there was nothing, right? So my exposure to training, you know, came very differently than somebody who is your age, right? Where you've got social media and you've got this influx of information, probably almost too much information, because that information comes without context. Whereas I was learning information and I had to apply it on the floor right away. And I didn't have constant things bombarding me as I was training. Like, I basically knew what the 25 other trainers on my staff were doing. And most of us had a lot of the same certifications. 10 years ago, I thought the FMS was the end all be all of all training, and it would be that way forever. Right? Like, I was teaching it to groups of trainers and onboarding for a national company, 50 to 100 trainers every single month, right? Wearing the t-shirt as I did it, you know? And then I got into other systems. I discovered DNS, I discovered FRC, I discovered PRI, I discovered IKN. And I kind of dove into all these other systems. And along the way, I read books like Anatomy Trains, and I got into Gary Ward's work. It, you know, it's as you start learning all these different systems, you realize that they all come back to the skeleton. And all we're doing is looking at movement through different lenses. But at the end of the day, we're not changing the actual skeleton, right? So when I see somebody with compression and an inhalation pattern, upper cross syndrome comes through my head.
Yeah.
Right. We're all talking about the same things, but nobody's using biomechanical terms because that's not marketable. Right. So I try to get away from the jargon as much as possible. Anything that's system specific, I try not to use in social media because I want to be able to relate my information to someone who has a, you know, a PRI background like yourself, amongst other things, to a level one NASM trainer at an Equinox in New York. I want them to be able to understand my information the same way and be able to apply it to the people that they see, right? Like, I want to provide utility. So when I'm talking to clients within this process and we start talking about building out models, right? The first thing we have to understand within any given model, and the model should be shaped around who you're working with, not what you know. The who determines the what, the who determines the why, right? If I'm working with a Gen Pop clientele, that is going to dictate what all of my training looks like. If I'm working with collegiate athletes, that's going to dictate what my training looks like, right? So those models are going to be inherently different. Neither are wrong, neither are right, right? So they're just contextually appropriate. So the first thing that we have to decide, right, is based on your education, your experience, and your beliefs, what are your training principles? Your individual ones, not what your favorite influencer is talking about on IGTV, right? Then as we start developing the model itself, we start thinking about who are you actually training from a broad demographic basis, and then we start narrowing it down to a client avatar. What do they need? What do they want? And what do they value? What language do they speak, right? Do they say inner abdominal pressure or do they say core, right? Do we say counternutation or do we say tuck your butt, right? Like, I need to know what language I'm going to be speaking with them, because they, if they don't understand what I say, none of it matters. Their experience dictates their training adherence. It dictates their intention for training. And it dictates my ability to get outcomes, right? So I want to use a language and I want to use things that they value to reach their actual outcomes. And I might have all these acronyms after my name, but the language that I use is typically going to be the language that they've used on their intake form within their goal selection. And I'm going to take everything back to that. And I'm going to leave the jargon behind. I'm going to leave the Latin behind. I'm going to leave the big words and the terminology behind. And I'm probably going to talk more with them about their kids and their weekend and their pets than I do about biomechanics.
Yeah.
Right. I'm going to make it as good of an experience as possible for them, because most of our clients don't want to be educated. they want to be instructed.
Yeah.
And I'm going to choose exercise selections and constraints that are hard to fuck up. Right. I'm going to put them in positions that they can't really mess up, and we're going to train them. Well and said. Then we're going to progress them. Right. And progression might be increasing load. It might be taking away constraints. It might be giving them alternative exercise selections. Depends on the goal. It depends on their ability to assimilate information and learn. It depends on their ability to express movement. Again, none of these things are wrong. They're individualized. So my model is very flexible, right? Like I have kind of a rule, you know, guidelines, right? Things I believe in that based on my experience, my education, I'm confident in my ability to apply to a population that needs those things. But I also know that I'm going to have outliers and I need to be flexible. I also know that I'm going to have new information put in front of me, hopefully, you know, year over year, that allows me to critically think about my current model and make changes. Right. And, you know, when I'm on social media, people ask me questions all the time about what I do and whether or not I think it's right or wrong. And my answer is typically, you know, I don't know, but I'm willing to ask myself more than anybody else does. I question my model more than anybody else ever will. And I critically think about what I'm doing and how I'm doing it, how I'm applying it. And when I'm working with my clients within my mentorship programs or whatever, like I'm not teaching them my model ever. I don't want them to have my model because my model is probably not going to work well for them, right? Because they don't have my experience. What I'm trying to help them do is develop a model of their own that allows them to leverage their own experiences and education to the maximal degree. Based on who they're training. And from there, they're going to grow over time and they're going to have new tools to pour into that. They might change training environments and have new applications. And I encourage them to do that. But I never have people take more courses before they refine what they already know, before they can provide an experience that's meaningful for their clients. Because at the end of the day, I've never had a client that understood what I was doing to the extent that I do, right? And most clients don't know the difference between what we would call good training or bad training, if we can even define those things, right? Yeah. But they always know if they're having a good experience. They always know if they like being with you for an hour. And you can have the best program in the world, but if somebody doesn't like spending an hour with you, they're not training with you, right? You can have a program that kind of sucks, but if you're a very personable person, people like spending time with you, they'll probably keep on training, right? And these are things that frustrate trainers that invest heavily in education, but don't invest heavily in the experience, that don't know how to communicate, that try to bludgeon their clients with language rather than, you know, being a person. And, you know, that's something I've seen time and time again on the floor within staffs that I worked on, that I managed. And it never fails. Every gym I've ever been in, the most successful trainer in that gym was rarely the most educated, which should tell us that education is not the determinant or the key determiner for success in this industry. It helps, but you get to a point of diminishing returns if you can't apply it correctly.
Yeah. Right?
And the applications in the language and the communication.
I think some coaches, it's hard for, because we're very passionate about what we do, mm-hmm. or at least most of us are. And I think that it's hard for us to take the step of understanding that our clients, like exactly what you said, they don't, I like how you said, they don't want to be educated. They just want to get the results they're seeking. It's like, imagine if you're not very handy and you have a plumbing problem. A plumber could come in and be like, okay, this is how you do this, 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 and this. And this is probably going to save you time next time you do it. But I don't give a shit. I just want to pay him to solve my problem so my problem goes away. In essence, that's kind of what we're doing for this individual. It's just that it's reversed and they're just paying us to help them with their, you know, fitness issue or performance they're seeking.
Absolutely. The example that I usually use with people is my accountant, right?
Yeah.
I care about outcomes. I do not need him to teach me tax law. Mm-hmm. I don't care at all. I'm going to come back to him every quarter for outcomes. He can teach me all he wants. I'm still not going to do it.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and that's again, like that point, right? It's the same thing with the plumber. Like you're not going to fix your own toilet and drain your septic tank. You're going to call somebody else in to do that. And you're going to pay them money to do that. Like we pay for those things. Right. And I think that's something that we need to understand as far as the things that we're also passionate about is if our clients were as passionate about the things that we're passionate about, the information's readily available and they'd be doing it. Right. And I think trainers obviously spend a lot of time talking to trainers and they get kind of a warped worldview, right? They get caught inside the echo chamber and then echo chambers within echo chambers that turn into systems, right? And by the time we get through this filtration process, now we have not only fitness people versus non-fitness people, which is already a huge outlier, right? We know that just look, you know, walk into a Walmart, right? And then we have the people who love fitness enough to be employed within fitness, right? Again, percentage of a percentage. And then we break it down into all of our systems. But if we're only talking to people within our system on the internet, right? If my posts are littered with things like ZOA and AFIR and PECs and BCAICs and acronyms that nobody else understands, XYZs and 123s, right? The people that actually understand what I'm saying aren't my consumer base. Mm-hmm. They're my peers, right? So am I looking to actually even educate people or am I just looking for validation within my peer group, right? I'm looking for an ego stroke, right? And when I'm talking to my actual clients, if I'm using these terms, I'm typically just overcomplicating things. I'm adding complexity to things that don't need to be complex. Right? Because if I want to produce outcomes, simplification is the name of the game. I want to make things as simple as possible to produce efficient outcomes, not as complex as possible. Right? So I'm going to use terms that they understand. I'm going to use exercises that they have familiarity with enough that we can program and progress. Everything's built and layered on top of something they're familiar with, right? Everything from exercise selection to terminology. And if they use the word abs, I use the word abs. They say core, I say core, right? I'm probably not talking about IOs in the rectus. Mm-hmm. I'm probably never even going to mention the diaphragm to one of my clients, right? If I put them in the right position, I know it's working. I can look at outcomes for that, you know? And I think that's an important concept to really understand because that, you know, going into social media, like I use a little more complex things, although not as complex as a lot of people, because my target market is trainers. But if I was trying to find clients on the internet, everything that I posted about would be in one of two categories of getting stronger or losing weight.
Yeah.
Feeling better. Right.
Right.
And does that mean I can't apply complex principles to those things? Absolutely not. Right. Those things apply. Am I going to talk about the complexity? No. I'm going to talk about the things that the client actually values. Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's when we start talking about language and we start talking about setting a training environment, those are things that we really need to understand, you know, and a lot of trainers spend a lot of time talking to other trainers. And not enough time talking to their clients. And they end up talking to their clients like their trainers. Mm. And it rarely works. And I think it's good to be able to bounce ideas off peers. Like I love sitting on this conversation right now and talking to you about things. But I also understand that we're both weirdos. And like the fact that we care this much about these things is strange. I know that. Right?
You're not wrong.
Yeah. I mean, it's like my wife is my filter, right? Yeah. She does not care about fitness at all, but she cares about abs and ass. She cares about how she looks, right? When I make a post, like she literally reads it and I'm like, hey, did you see that? She's like, too nerdy. right? You know, it's like, she'll tell me straight up, you know? Yeah. So like, we'll be training and I'll write her a program or something. And she's like, no, like, I don't want any of this stuff. Give me something that I can do. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important concept, and that's a good check for me, you know. And at Rebel, we're fortunate that I would say 95% of our clientele from a training perspective are other coaches. Right. So we can have conversations and we can program things and have descriptions that add a little education into things, because those people do care about that. We can fill that bucket for both ourselves and them. But if I'm training a Gen Pop client, or even if I'm training like an athlete, I need to understand that they probably don't care about anything but the result. Mm-hmm. And everything along the way has to be things that they enjoy. And if it's not, it's a waste of time, and it's probably a deterrent to the outcome itself.
Yeah.
Like, I've watched trainers give clients balloons on a crowded gym floor in Manhattan with 1,000 other people walking, right? Weight loss clients. How do you explain to Peter, who needs to lose 50 pounds, why laying on the floor and blowing in a balloon is going to help him lose that weight?
Good luck.
Yeah. You're never going to see Peter again.
Yeah.
Right. And these are important things for us to understand. Like, we have to hit big rocks. And a lot of the things that we talk about on the internet and, you know, the tribes argue about, a lot of the time I come back to the question of, does it even matter? Right. And a lot of this has to do with being in environments where I've trained within a lot of different systems. I've had successful client outcomes in FMS, in DNS, in FRC, in PRI, in combinations of this, of all of them, right? It kind of takes me back to looking at buy-in and beliefs and intention, right? Like, I have clients up until the last two, three years that still foam rolled. And I never changed them from foam rolling, because when they got off that foam roller, they moved better. It produced the outcome I was looking for. Was it physiological? Was it psychosomatic? Was it built entirely on belief and autonomics and getting them more parasympathetic, more familiar? I don't know, right? But would including a new drill and telling them the old one was wrong create a new threat response? Decrease movement? Decrease experience? Maybe. Do I need to change what's not broken? Probably not.
I like that.
And I think it's important to be real, right? I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up on a farm. I watched people work doing manual labor every single day and not do a single respiration drill and have no pain and live their lives happily, right? You know, so again,
but could they expand their posterior rib cage?
Probably not. Right. And, or maybe they just didn't need to. Again, I think the other thing that we have to consider all the time is all of these things are trying to get us back to a baseline of things that just happen.
Right. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. And these are things that we shouldn't ever have to worry about as human beings.
Yes.
Because the body is, the structure is meant to facilitate an action. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, and again, there's variability within those actions and there's variability within individual structures, but a skeleton's still a skeleton, right? A femur's still a femur, an acetabulum still an acetabulum, a rib cage is still a rib cage. And when I start looking at things of that nature, right, it really kind of takes me back to maybe people just need to move more to get better at moving.
Yeah.
Right. And maybe the drills aren't the secret sauce. Like, I would love to see a study, nobody will ever fund it, but I would love to see a population side by side of people who got sensory motor competency drills for 6 months and people who got a dedicated walk program.
Probably be pretty similar.
And to see who came out with better movement.
Yeah.
Who felt better, right? I know who I'd put my money on. You know, and that always kind of takes me back to, you know, what are the big rocks for any individual client, right? And it might be lifestyle coherence measures. It might just be getting stronger. It might be structural positional drills. But I don't think it's always structural positional drills, right? So I think when we're looking at that model and we're looking at our assessment process, we're looking at, you know, who we're training and why we're training them, what they want, we have to consider all of these variables and we have to kind of figure out what that path looks like for them based off of those things.
Yeah, I think like humans up until, you know, not all that long ago, relatively speaking, like we were just meant to walk and move. And that's so obvious. But, you know, when I started doing the coronavirus thing, I went from standing 7 to 8 hours a day to sitting for that period of time. And my left Achilles and my right shoulder all of a sudden acted up. And I've never experienced that in my life. Went out and played 18 holes of golf, completely went away. Yeah. And, you know, it's just getting up. And that's so true. I love the point about just a walking program. Wasn't there like a something done where they just gave people with low back pain walking and it was like phenomenal, the outcomes?
I think there's definitely some studies out there. Like I definitely can't cite them. That might be homework for you to put in the show notes. But yeah, I think when we start looking at just a low level activity like walking, right? If we truly believe the body can self-organize enough in sensory motor drills, but we don't believe that the body can self-organize into something that we've literally been doing for hundreds of thousands of years, that's hard for me to swallow, like that belief system, right? Like I definitely read a tweet or a post or something from a well-known fitness person, like big following, that we have to teach people how to walk. And it blew my mind, right? Like if we think that people aren't capable of learning how to walk on their own, like we're not talking about paraplegics. We're not talking about even like people who are in, you know, medically obese or morbidly obese categories. We're talking about just people who aren't active enough. No, like just start walking, right? Walking more will probably get you better at walking. You will develop strategies that allow for those things. Your body will self-organize. Our body is built to do it. We're not trying to do something that we're not structurally prepared for, right? Like, and this was all built, I think the conversation was built on, you know, getting people ready to run, right? Which again, higher demand activity, more impact, like that makes sense. We probably need to do some training to get to that point. But if you're talking to me about walking and teaching people how to walk, I think we're building in fragility mindsets at that point. Mm. And I'm not a believer at all in that. Right. So again, it's just looking at the population we're working with. Everybody's sedentary. We know what America is, right? Even most of our training clients that we would call in shape, they train an hour to 90 minutes a day and sit the rest of the time. They're still sedentary compared to our ancestors.
Exactly. Yeah.
They're just trained, right? Mm-hmm. And if you look at what the human body did up really until the Industrial Revolution, we worked. We did low level aerobic activity all day, pretty much, with the occasional spurt of high intensity anaerobic activity, right? Running away from something, chasing after something, right? Pretty much. And I think that's where when we look at what the body's doing, like we inject the high level intensity stuff we're training, but we lack the low level aerobic stuff that we're really supposed to be doing the majority of the time because we spend our time sitting. Mm-hmm. And I think if we talk to our clients and we start looking at dedicated walking times in addition to their training as a means of recovery and self-organization, we're probably going to get pretty good results on a lot of things. Everything from sleeping better to weight loss because of BMR increases to just getting more sun, more photons and circadian regulation from that standpoint. Walk with a loved one and you're probably also going to improve your relationships, right? So we look at all these other kind of biopsychosocial phenomenons that we would be considering with feeling better, right? And we can probably improve all of those things through things outside of the gym as well. Does that make that a big rock? I would say yes. That's something that I'm going to consider when I'm working with people.
I think ultimately what you're kind of getting at is like how simple all of this really can be. And I think there's a lot of trainers, like, I don't know, I think I'm still in this phase myself where I'm just, you know, young and trying to soak up as much information as humanly possible. And I think that comes out of a desire to be better and follow my passion. But I think a part of it is also like a kind of like an inherent denial that like it really is so much easier than a lot of us want to make it out to be. And like 90% of the benefits come from just these very basic things that we've been having this discussion about. And really, if you just had people do, you know, a relatively basic fitness program, then you would coop most of the fitness benefits. And if we're just talking about health for most human beings, that's probably enough. And even when it comes to strength and conditioning, like, yeah, you probably need a more complex approach. But if you gave people, you know, the basic patterns and you put it in a logical, thought out manner, really, like, you know, that's how much more, like, it's just diminishing returns at that point. So I think it's great that, you know, people such as myself, as in this example, we're trying to grow and get better. But ultimately, a lot of this stuff isn't that overly complicated, even though we almost want it to be in a way.
And again, like, I don't want anybody to think that I'm not saying education isn't important.
No.
Because if that's the case, I have wasted hundreds and thousands of dollars and hours, you know, over the course of my career. And I think we have to differentiate things that are important versus things that are useful. Mm. Right. And it's almost like the Eisenhower matrix, right? We look at urgency versus importance. And I think we look at utility versus important. And I think when we start looking at some of these very nuanced, complex systems, like, these things are important. The complexities and understanding the complexities are important. But I think you can go one of two routes as you get, you know, kind of down into these rabbit holes, is you can use the complexities to better understand the simplification of the system. Mm-hmm. Or you can layer complexity on top of complexity for more complexity. And if I'm working on my own education and I'm trying to just be a lifelong student and understand the human body, which I am, I love the complexity. I'm like you, like, I want to know the ins and outs of everything. I want to know how every system overlaps. I want to understand, like, how the human body works. I also understand that I probably never will. I never will, right, fully. There's too much going on, and the environment dictates so much of it. And the environment is entropic and chaos, and we can't predict any of that anyway, right? So again, it's like, we're never going to know how the body works. We're just going to have better guesses, you know? So if I'm looking at what I can use and what's useful to my clients based on their goals, I want to better understand the complexities for more options to make a more useful program and application. Mm-hmm. The complexities allow me to cut the fat, right? Understanding more tools allows me to differentiate those tools and better apply them given the context in front of me, you know? And that's where I look at complex systems leading to simplistic applications.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where, again, like, when I think about, like, prep, right? I look at sensory motor prep. These things are useful until they're not. Right? Like, if I'm working with an untrained client, low level respiration drills are probably going to be great for a short period of time, right? Stress accommodation, right? As soon as that person adapts to that stimulus, it's no longer stronger than the compensatory strategy. Mm. So I have to find ways to add more stress to my new corrective strategy, right? I have to find ways to train it and load it. And I need to get that person off the floor and super compensated probably as quickly as I can if I want long-term adaptation and tissue adaptation. If I'm working with one of my power lifters, right? Like, we work with people with 1,000-pound deadlifts and 750-pound squats. Bare breathing doesn't do shit for that person, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we have to put them in a chest supported row variation holding hundreds of pounds. Sometimes they have to do inversions holding 100-pound dumbbells to their chest to get posterior expansion.
Yeah.
Low level stuff doesn't work for that person, right? We have to be able to adapt. And these are the things that they don't teach you in the 3-day seminar. right? You have to be able to take that, look who you're training, and adapt it really quickly if you want it to actually work. And, you know, again, it's interesting because of the content that I put out. Like, I have people message me all the time and try to teach me PRI. They just took the seminar 3 days ago. I'm like, I took those courses almost 7 years ago. Like, I'm familiar. I've been where you're at. Like, I've done the bell curve of complexity and I'm right back here. Right. And that's cool. Right. I've had people try to explain FMS to me. It's like, I taught FMS when you were in middle school to professional trainers. Like, that's cool. Like, and again, this is where social media, you know, tells a very limited story, right? Like, I've had 2 years on the gram of consistent posting, and that's less than 5% of my entire career, right? And probably 10% of all the things that I've learned. You know, I was talking to a mentee today. I probably use less than 10% of all the information I've learned at this point. Right. Again, important versus utility. I know those other things. I'm familiar with them, but they're not applicable. Right. And if they become applicable, I've got them in my back pocket and I can pull them out and have some tricks up my sleeve, but I'm going to use the things that produce the best outcomes every single time, mm-hmm. not the things that look the coolest or whatever, you know, or the most novel. Or the most complex.
I think that's well said, and something that the more good experienced coaches I talk to, the more they kind of gravitate towards. They all say it differently, but it's something along those lines. And I think that speaks towards kind of this natural progression of things as you get mm-hmm. deeper into the game. I just had one final question for you. I think something else that's been a theme within this conversation is that it's a lot less about the training aspects of things and more about how you're managing that relationship with the client or the team you're working with or whatever the case is. A tool that I've used to get kind of like an understanding of this individual that potentially could be my client, like during like the consultation, is just ask them sort of how you touched on it. Why multiple times? Just kind of get a feel, like don't be intrusive, obviously, like read the person and get a feel for how much they're willing to share with you. But just kind of digging into why, like, why do you want to lose fat? Well, you know, I don't like the way I look in the mirror. Why don't you like the way you look in the mirror? You know, I'm simplifying this conversation.
Yeah.
And then you just keep going on and on until you figure out that she got a divorce from her husband and she doesn't feel comfortable in her own skin because of blah, blah, blah reasons as well. But then once you understand that, you know where this individual really is coming from on an emotional level. And I think that also helps them feel like they were heard and understood and that you are actually keeping their best, true, genuine intentions in mind, as opposed to, well, they know I want to lose fat, but so what, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and that's a really good point. And that's something I talk with people a lot about. It's never just 30 pounds unless you've got an athlete trying to make a weight cut. Mm-hmm. Like when I'm working with Gen Pop clients, like the majority of the people that give me a number that they want to lose from a weight loss perspective, for instance, my follow-up question to that is, great, how much do you weigh now? Most of them don't know. Well, if you don't know how much you weigh now, how do you know you want to lose 30 pounds? Right? Or if they do know that they weigh 185 pounds, they don't know their body composition, right? And we know that 30 pounds can, you know, 100 and, you know, in this example, 155 pounds can look drastically different depending on what that body composition is, right? So at that point, it's not a number, it's a something. It's an aesthetic. It's an emotional reaction to something that happened in their lives, right? And so I'm doing the same thing you are, right? At that point, I'm trying to figure out, okay, why weight loss, right? Why did you slide into my DMs today? Or why did you walk into the gym and ask about personal training or whatever environment that you're training into? What made you come to me today? What happened? Because you were still 30 pounds overweight in your eyes yesterday. And probably 6 months prior to this, Like, what was it that triggered this today? Mm. Right? Like, I want to know what those things are. Because when I get to the point where I can no longer ask why, and I get to the true, we'll call it a stimulus of change, right? Now I have an anchor, right? I have a reason. And, you know, we can go Simon Sinek on it. We can kind of do the whole thing. But at this point, like, I'm going to tie that anchor back to every single thing we do. If I pick an exercise, it's going to tie back to the anchor. If I pick a cardiac output drill or a lifestyle coherence habit, right? Behavioral change, it's going to always go back to that anchor because I know that's what they value the most. And if I can tie it back to the anchor in the outcome, I can make it dopaminergic, right? I can create the neuropsychological want to work through and adhere to this program. But if I can't give them a reason for what I'm doing and it doesn't have a point in their eyes, even if it is quote unquote important, it might not be useful, right? If I can't relate why this respiratory drill is going to come back to a 30 pound weight loss drill, they will not do it. They'll go through the motions, but they're not going to do it with the intention. And when that package runs out, I'm never going to see them again. And I didn't help anybody at that point. Because we know that if we're picking these exercise selections, if we're picking these drills, intention matters. Right? I can put you in the right position. I can put you in the right orientation. I can pick all the right constraints. If you don't do these things with a high level of effort, it's not going to work. Right? So I have to be able to tie everything back to that central anchor of why they came to see me before. And for me, the intake process is the most important part of a training relationship. And it's skipped over by so many trainers. It's rushed through, right? Because especially the corporate gym landscape encourages that, right? Like, I have an hour to sell this person. I need to get them on the floor as quickly as possible because their expectation is not to sit down with me and talk, right? So how do we change that process? This goes into the model that I help people build, right? Like, what's your intake and consultation process look like, right? Because what I'm going to think about is I'm always going to send out that intake form ahead of time, and I'm not even going to book a consultation until they finish it. And then when we actually have that consultation, now I can ask follow-up questions instead of initial questions. We can get in the weeds. We can make this contextual, right? Because I know where you stand. I can ask better questions for better answers. And I can have a shorter conversation with you, right? I can go through, I can take the time to go through a movement, a screen, or an assessment, or whatever you want to call it. And I can get you on the floor and show you practical application instead of sitting with you for 45 minutes and never seeing you again.
That's beautiful. Right.
And, you know, I think it, again, it's just like, how do you plan these things, right? Because we know the drill. Most of the trainers listening to this have been in plenty of consultations where the client did not want to be there.
Yeah.
Because their expectation going into a gym and seeing a trainer was that they were going to work out. And it should be, right? So how do we get the information that we want and still provide the experience that they want? We have to plan and prepare. We have to have systems in place. We have to have practices in place. And we have to deliver clear expectations to the people seeing us to ensure that we're all on the same page going into that relationship. And if I can plan and prepare for that, I can set a better experience. I can meet their expectations and deliver the outcomes they're looking for and greatly increase my chance of them actually working with me.
I like that. I like that. That's I've learned a lot from this conversation just in the last hour. So Kyle, man, thank you for coming on. You're a wealth of knowledge and I appreciate you taking the time out of your day to do this.
Hey, thank you for having me again. I really appreciate it.